also sometimes academics act as if creativity and the arts are new to academic practice. They aren't. It's just a lesson that we need to keep learning and relearning.
Welcome to Talking Creativity, the Crania podcast from Dublin City University. I'm Ciarán Dunn.
I'm Joe Binetti.
And I'm Tim Hannigan. In this series, we talk to academic experts on creativity, creative practitioners, people from the creative industries and the arts, and those working across disciplines and at the boundaries between scholarship and practice.
The aim of these conversations is to dig into creativity, to figure out what it means, and above all, to explore ways to encourage it in any field or discipline.
The Crania Project is based at Dublin City University and funded by the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education.
In this episode, we're talking to Dr. Patricia Levy. It's a rousing and thought-provoking conversation about transdisciplinarity, the power and purpose of arts-based research, the ethical imperatives for public scholarship, and the exciting things that happen when academics step beyond their own comfort zone and let things flow. Patricia Levy is an independent sociologist, award-winning author, and an authority on arts-based research. She has published over 35 books and has been widely acclaimed for both her critical and creative works. She's edited book series with Oxford University Press, Guildford Press, and Brill Sense, including the groundbreaking social fiction series. Her recent novel, Shooting Stars, won the 2021 Independent Press Award Distinguished Favourite Contemporary Novel. Her Handbook of Arts-Based Research won the 2018 USA Best Book Award for Best Academic Book. And she has a shelf full of awards for her other books too, as well as career awards from the American Creativity Association, the American Educational Research Association, and various other organisations. And we are delighted to have her joining us for Talking Creativity. Patricia, you are very welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, we always start these conversations, whoever we're speaking to, with a standard question. What single word do you associate with the concept of creativity?
Freedom. Freedom is the first word that comes to mind. Freedom in thinking, in constructing, in making, in inquiry, in learning things that we wouldn't otherwise learn. So freedom.
I think you're not the first person who's said that. I'll sort of move on to the what I think is the meat of the topic here, and certainly your particular area of expertise, which is arts-based research. Now, you're forever being asked to explain exactly what that is. So I'm very sorry, I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to do it again for our listeners. But I do want to give it a little tiny modification within the area of creativity. So could you explain what arts-based research is, but could you also try and put it specifically in the broad context of creativity?
So arts-based research is research that involves researchers in any discipline adapting the creative arts in their research project. So they might use the arts for one phase of a research project, data generation, analysis, interpretation, or representation, or the arts may be used as the entire method of inquiry. So that's sort of a working definition of what arts-based research is. And it requires researchers to be creative in innumerable ways. So arts-based research demands flexibility, experimentation, cycles of revisions, thinking metaphorically, symbolically, and thematically. And it acknowledges that research is a process of discovery. It also pushes researchers to be creative in how they merge their scholarly and arts practices, often resulting in the asking of new questions or coming at old questions in new ways or developing entire new research practices. And it can also foster creativity because it can breed cross-pollination. So, for example, I'm a sociologist and I've done arts-based projects with creative arts therapists. And if it was not for working in ABR, in arts-based research, we wouldn't have come together in those those ways and merged our different skills and expertise and ways of looking at the world. So it really fosters creativity in many ways. And certainly it's not the only shift in academia towards creative research, but I do think it's an important shift. And it's also transdisciplinary by nature. ABR requires people to think in transdisciplinary ways because you're using more than one disciplinary perspective. So you're using your arts practice and arts perspective, but also the disciplinary training from whatever field you've come from.
And that's something that comes up again and again in these conversations, whoever we're talking to, that value of interdisciplinarity and transdisciplinarity is such a key fertilizer for any kind of creativity. I just noted that you mentioned that it's not the only shift towards creativity in academia. Could you just very briefly give us a sense of what other engagements are going on with creativity in academia that you're engaged with or aware of?
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of them is just a push towards transdisciplinary collaborations. And you see this at lots of universities and even lower in the education system, you know, before the university level, you see teachers and professors coming up with what some schools call learning communities, but they're called different things. What they really are is that they're courses that were created by professors from different disciplines coming together. And you see that in research practice as well. You know, we've sort of went from a disciplinary model to multidisciplinary to interdisciplinary to transdisciplinary, where you're really transcending disciplines. So you're using your expertise, but you're asking questions that wouldn't otherwise be asked, and you're coming at them in new ways. And I think a big part of all of this is the push to public scholarship, the push to make research more accessible to those stakeholders who it could actually benefit. And I think it's forcing both teachers, professors, and researchers to get creative in the ways that they think about and conduct their research. So, you know, one avenue for that is the arts, and arts-based research is one avenue, but it's not the only one. There are new qualitative research methods. There are all kinds of new research methods and practices that are coming up to sort of meet this demand of being creative, but not just for the sake of being creative, so that we can do something new and we can engage audiences inside and outside of the academy in ways that might otherwise not be possible.
I'll come back to that idea of a push towards public scholarship in a little while. And I was just thinking there as you were speaking, this idea that perhaps, hopefully, we're moving away from this strict disciplinarity. In a way, it's a return to the past, because before the 20th century, people were less confined to these silos. There was a lot more generalism in scholarship, wasn't there?
Absolutely. And a lot of the way that our disciplines have developed, they developed to organize our professional lives. It actually has nothing to do with the way schools of thought operate. So really, I mean, a lot of what we understand as the contemporary academy just developed as a way to structure our work lives and our teaching lives. But really, these disciplines have been severed from one another. And most of the greatest thinkers, those we revere the most across disciplines, we're transdisciplinary thinkers. I mean, when you look at the people who've won Nobel Prizes over the years, what you'll find is a list of transdisciplinary thinkers. They're people who worked in multiple disciplines at once and had expertise in multiple disciplines. And so this idea that we became very disciplinary again, it was really a way to organize and structure our work lives. And so this return is so important. And it's something I bring up a lot because, you know, I do fiction as a research practice. I write novels and short stories as my research practice. And a lot of people are like, oh, like, that's so new, that's so emergent, that's so cutting edge, that's so out there. And I'm like, not really. I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre was doing it. He won the Nobel Prize. I mean, Simone de Beauvoir was doing it. Zora Neale Hurston was doing it. So this idea, you know, that these things are so new and risky, it's really just a return in the contemporary academy of what knowledge building and dissemination used to look like.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think you demonstrate that in your own practice wonderfully. We'll talk about your novels a little bit later on, but I do want to look a little bit further into the idea of arts-based research as a form of data generation, because I think a lot of academics would be able to grasp the concept of using arts practice to disseminate research, even if they might not feel comfortable about doing it themselves. But they would probably find it a bit more difficult to grasp the idea of actually generating data using arts practice. I wonder if you could kind of explain to somebody not working in the arts how they might use arts-based research to generate data.
Absolutely. So, I mean, one thing you have to recognize and acknowledge is that the arts themselves are a method of inquiry. They are a unique way of knowing. So while quantitative research is a unique way of knowing, qualitative research is a unique way of knowing, the arts are also a unique way of knowing. So just like any other research practice, art making is a process of discovery, and it is a generative process. So you do come up with questions, insights, things that you could not have planned in advance, just like in any other research practice. And I understand that if you're someone who's never had an arts practice, that might be difficult to understand, but it's something that you can always experiment with. So for example, when I'm writing a novel, I can't disavow my sociological perspective. So it's always there. It's a lens through which I see the world. So it influences everything that I write. It influences the way I interpret a character's story, the way I see the plot unfolding, the way I see the relationships between characters developing, the way I see the setting or the larger context in which these lives are unfolding. And I learn about my subject as I write about it. And anyone can sort of practice this. So for example, if you are coming from a social science background, so you're coming from psychology or sociology or anthropology, or you're coming from the humanities, philosophy, history, just take a concept you're interested in from literature. So whatever that concept or theory or idea from literature is, and start to free write about it. Start to write about it from the perspective of a made up person. If you have done qualitative research over the years, so you've done interview research or focus groups or ethnographic field work, take some of your notes and just create sort of a composite character. It doesn't have to be that you're going to publish it or it doesn't have to become a book, just an experiment. Create a composite character of the kind of person you've typically interviewed or the kind of person you met at your field site and write their story. Write their story about their environment or whatever the topic of the interview was. Let them explore some concept you're interested in and just free write. And the goal of this is if you just free write, what you'll see is that you start to develop insights about these people, about this topic, about the literature. So wherever you pulled your initial seed from, you start to develop insights you didn't have when you began. And in order for that to happen, whether it's writing fiction or engaging in any other art making process, you decide to make a collage, you decide to write poetry, whatever it is you decide to do, you have to push through the beginning when you're sort of sitting there stuck. You have to push through, not checking your social media, not checking your cell phone, not that all interrupts flow. So you can't do any of that. You have to sit there and just push, even if what you're writing is garbage. It doesn't matter. The point is just to get going until you can get into some kind of flow where you're writing in this fictional world, but based on a concept, a theory, a participant, an observation from a field site, whatever it is. And once you get into that flow, it might take 5 minutes, it might take 20 minutes, whatever it takes, just keep writing. When you're done, see, have I learned something? Is there an insight developing? Am I starting to get somewhere other than where I thought I was going to go? And I think what you'll find is you'll find very quickly that art making is indeed a generative act. So it does create insights and raise questions that wouldn't come up otherwise. So just as an example, so I wanted to write a novel about women's experiences pursuing their dreams. So really, what does the pursuit of happiness look like for women? And in my book, it's American women. So what does the pursuit of happiness look like for women in the United States? And how can we understand their pursuit of their dreams in the context of Me Too experiences? So experiences of gender inequality, of sexual harassment, of being looked over in favor of lesser men, all of these kinds of things that we know women experience over the course of their lives. So this is something that I've researched for many years as a sociologist who studies women's lives and relationships. I've had my own experiences. I've witnessed many other people having experiences. I've done countless interviews with women who have spoken about their experiences. So it's a subject that I know a bit about. And I had planned this novel, so I had an outline. I knew what I was going to write. I knew all the major plot points. I knew the ultimate message. And all that being said, as I began writing it, I began developing insights into the social psychological process of what happens when you have an experience of sexual harassment, say when you're 15 or 16. How does that impact you when you're 28? How does that impact you when you're 42? How are those experiences a part of what shapes your dreams, shapes your ability to go after them, shapes your perception of what's available to you, shapes how you respond to later events? So if an event like that happens when you're 15, what happens when that happens when you're 18? What happens when it happens when you're 30? All of these things. And so again, this is a topic that as a woman, I can personally relate to. I've done research about, I've interviewed people about, and I had outlined this novel in advance, and the novel ultimately became my novel film. But it wasn't until the act of writing that I really understood the layers of what this does to a woman's life and the psychological process and how that occurs within this larger socio-historical context. And lucky for me, I had already written many works of fiction. So I was expecting this. I was expecting there will be things I don't know until I'm writing. There will be things I learn. I didn't know what those things would be. I didn't know if they'd be particularly meaningful or profound or not. But I knew that it would be a learning process because I've done this a lot. And I have to say that I had moments writing that novel where I was sort of stunned when I saw how the pieces fit together in each of the characters' lives in ways that I could not have known in advance, because writing was my method of learning about it. The act of rigorous writing was the method of inquiry, and these insights could not have developed in any other way.
I think that's such an important point. And in a way, it's so obvious, but it sometimes needs to be stated boldly, really. I mean, writing or any other form of creative practice is such a potent way to shape thoughts and to give meaning to things that are sort of floating around and haven't quite found their shape.
Absolutely. And I just want to give a shout out to Laurel Richardson, who is one of my sheroes in the world, but she's a feminist sociologist. She's retired now, but she still writes, and she's written memoir, creative nonfiction, nonfiction, you name it. And one of the things that she has said many times is that writing is how she understands what she thinks. It's how she comes to know what she thinks. And I think it's so important to put that out there. I mean, how do you know what you think in the first place? How do you have insights? And writing is a process for figuring that stuff out.
Just sort of going back to that idea of public scholarship, there's a general understanding, I think, in academia, that we need to engage beyond our own sort of narrow field, and public impact is certainly something people chase. But I sometimes get the sense that there's a danger that academic engagement with arts or creative practice can end up in a little side annex. Maybe there's a project that has an arts thing bolted onto it. So somebody does a collaboration with a poet or a visual artist for the sake of public engagement, and everyone loves it, and they get some nice photos for the social media feed from the college, and it ticks the right impact box. And then the arts practitioner goes back to their studio, and the academics go back to the campus and start working on the conference paper or the journal article, which they see as the serious bit of the project. So how do we get beyond that? And how do we thoroughly embed arts-based research and creative practice within academic practice, so it just becomes a normal thing, and it's not this strange meeting of two worlds?
Yeah, I mean, you're spot on. I cannot tell you how many, you know, messages I get on Facebook and emails I get, particularly from graduate students who want to do an ABR component, to some larger projects, so their thesis or something they're publishing. And the way they always frame it to me is like, oh, well, I have to do this like 150-page nonfiction thing, but then I was thinking of tacking this other thing on. And I understand, it's because they're under enormous pressure, and that, so I don't blame them, but they're under this enormous pressure from their university and the way the system is currently set up to produce this, so-called scholarly work. And so it's often, the ABR component is often an afterthought in many ways, even if it's the most exciting part of the project and even if it's the part that has the biggest impact. So I say that there are a few things that we need. The first thing we really need is we need to get honest with ourselves about the reality of conventional conference papers and journal articles, because the reality is actually pretty bleak. So first of all, do people read them? Are they generally any good? Do they generally make any real difference in the world? So we're always asking hard questions about arts-based research and creative practice of any kind, but we don't ask these same hard questions about those conventional practices. And really we should, because what we'll find out very quickly is that academic journal articles are scarcely read inside or outside of the academy. So first of all, they're completely inaccessible to the public. So nobody outside of a university setting is reading them. They are circulate in university libraries, which nobody else has access to. Subscriptions are very expensive. And even if all that weren't true, they're loaded with jargon. You need a PhD in a specific field to even understand them. And generally speaking, they lack the qualities of good writing. I mean, most academics don't spend their leisure time, right, reading journal articles. That's not what they read on a plane or a beach. And there's a reason. I mean, even academics don't want to read this stuff. And there's a myth that, well, this stuff is well read within the academy. But that's a complete myth, too, because journal articles are actually really poorly read even within the academy. In the social sciences and humanities, there are some studies that have shown that 90% of journal articles have an audience of 3 to 8 readers. I mean, 3 to 8 readers, like seriously. I mean, I could go stand on a street corner here and read a poem out loud. I bet I get more than 3 to 8 audience members. So it's, this idea that this stuff is well written and well read is really problematic in the first place. So the first thing I would say is let's start asking hard questions about this conventional practice and what the point of it is and if it's doing any good and all of that. And then we also need to abandon the idea that artwork and any creative work is less rigorous, serious, or meaningful. It isn't. I mentioned earlier, there's much we could learn from reminding ourselves that historically the giants in many fields have actually been creative thinkers and writers. So, I mentioned earlier, just consider the field of philosophy. So you have people like Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, two of the most famous existential philosophers in the world, in history. And they both authored numerous plays, short stories, and novels that espoused their theories. So in reality, some of what we have deemed in academia the greatest minds are actually people that have turned to literary work and other art practices as well. And I think also sometimes academics act as if creativity and the arts are new to academic practice. But as you mentioned earlier, and as I've just said again, they aren't. It's just a lesson that we need to keep learning and relearning. So I would say to those people who are, think ABR creative practice is sort of like cute and fun and it will, tick a box that I had impact, I had public engagement, and then they sort of move on to so-called serious work. Look at the reality of that so-called serious work. Is it reaching anybody inside or outside of the academy? Is it doing anything other than creating a line on your CV so that you can jump through a professional hoop, which I understand is a real material constraint. And so I understand why people do it, but does that work exist for any other purpose? Much of it does not. And then really start to think about how powerful artwork is in our own personal lives and how it can be in our work lives. And this is serious practice. And I will just say as a little aside for those folks listening who do engage in an arts practice that I want to say, I know what you do is challenging and difficult and rigorous. And I'm someone who, I've published, 35 to 40 books or so. Probably about 20, 25 of those are nonfiction. And I've also published hundreds of articles, academic articles, conference presentations, op-eds, all different kinds of nonfiction things, as well as all my works of fiction. And so I can attest to the fact that the reality is that my arts practice is extremely rigorous and difficult and challenging. It's also enjoyable and pleasurable, and I love it, and I get a lot out of it. And I hope that people who expose themselves to it do it as well. But this idea that it's somehow easier, it's not. I mean, I would make the argument as someone who's published quite a lot of academic nonfiction as well as fiction, that writing fiction is actually much harder, and to try and do it well is actually much harder. And I imagine the same thing is true of any arts practice. So these are not easy things to do, and they're not easy things to do well. And so we should be mindful of that as well.
You went exactly where I was going to go with the follow-up question at the end there, that idea that that just because something is more engaging or more accessible or more aesthetically pleasing doesn't mean it's easier to produce. Quite the opposite, in fact. It's pretty easy to write badly. It's not so easy to write well, and certainly not engaging.
So easy for an academic to write the jargon and all of that stuff. I mean, big deal. It's like everyone's trying to prove how smart they are. We already know what degree we have. We know you can use big words. I mean, look, I know plenty of big words. I can use them if I want to. But it's a lot more difficult to write a short blog or op-ed for a general audience that covers the same points and is understandable and digestible. And this is not about dumbing things down, because believe me, I've written op-eds that are one page that have been a lot harder than 300-page books I've written, because I could go on and on in like academic language, and I know it, and it's easy. How do you take those complicated ideas and make them simple? This is actually difficult, and art making is difficult, and making good art is difficult. Making art that will engage other people. All of these things are actually really, really rigorous. And they can be just as, if not more rigorous than these so-called conventional research practices. So this idea that it isn't is, you know, yes. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but yes, 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 with an exclamation point.
Do you think that possibly some of the challenge, some of the difficulty in getting academics more generally to engage with this kind of thing may, even at a subconscious level, perhaps have something to do with a fear of putting themselves in that vulnerable position of making themselves accessible to more than the 3 to 8 people who are going to read and understand that paper? Is there some reluctance to drop some of the mystique, some of the impenetrability created by that jargon?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. And I think it's like a multi-layered fear, because first of all, art is judged in a very different way than academic scholarship or traditional academic scholarship is judged. So people have visceral responses, like, you know, nobody really loves or hates your journal article. It's just not the way in which we engage with something like that. But people will love or hate a song or a film or a novel or a play. They will have strong reactions. They will or they will not laugh at the bits that the author wanted them to laugh at. It's a very strong emotional response. And so one of the things when you put yourself out there and you create art is that you are going to get much stronger responses to that art than you would ever get to any journal article you're going to write or any academic nonfiction book you're going to write. The second part of it is you actually will get a response because people will be exposed to it. Now, whether it's 100 people read your novel or 50,000 people read your novel, more people are likely to read that novel or see that play or hear that song or whatever it is than they are to read any academic article you've ever written. On top of that, there's no delay in audience response. So when you put an academic journal article out, there's typically a huge gap between when you wrote it and when it actually comes out, and then when you get any response. So you write the article, it often takes a year, sometimes 2 years for it to be published, because that's how dinosaur the academic journal system is. So you do this article, you know, a year, 2 years later, it comes out. So you've moved on. You're completely detached from this thing already. And then there's no immediate response, maybe one, because nobody's read it. And two, even if they had, it's very unlikely people are going to start leaving Facebook comments or Instagram posts or email you about your journal article. It just doesn't happen. So the way in which you will ever get any kind of feedback or criticism is you'll get citations. If you get anything, you get citations, and people are really only citing it to forward their own research agenda, which you're very well aware of. And they'll either cite it as something they agree with or cite it as something they don't agree with. So that's about as sterile a response to something as you could possibly get. So you've now created a gap of like 1 to 3 years between when you've written the thing and when you're going to get any kind of response whatsoever, if you get a response. And then that response is going to be completely, completely sterile and sanitary. And so it's a completely different world. And at the end of the day, you always have the ability to say, well, I'm the expert. I have a PhD. I know those particular big words. I did this study. That's what it is. Very different thing if you're putting out a painting you've created, a film you've created, a novel you've created. Yes, you are bringing your expertise to it. Yes, you are bringing your artistry to it, but everyone feels the ability to viscerally respond to art, to critique it, to criticize it, to leave a negative review online, or a positive review, whatever it might be. Everyone has a response to it. The response is immediate. And on top of it, there's nothing sterile about it because you have a strong relationship to your art. Whoever you are, I don't believe there's any artist out there that doesn't have a strong personal relationship to the art they create. And then those who choose to respond to it are having a strong reaction to it as well, because mostly the people who will respond to it really loved it or really hated it. That's most of the response that you get to art. So, yes, you have to deal with critique in a way you didn't before. You have to deal with visibility in a way you didn't have to before. And it's all centered on something that is you're probably extremely sensitive about because it's extremely personal to you. Someone, you know, critiquing a character in one of my novels, it feels like someone critiquing my daughter. And I don't say that lightly because these characters, they are my friends, they're my family, even the ones that are sort of wretched human beings in some way, I have deep empathy for. I know their backstories, I know more that's on the page, and I love them. And I know that I poured my heart and soul into them. And so it is very difficult to take all that in. You expose yourself in a way that academics just are not used to. Academics, there's this, you know, whole image of standing in an ivory tower, disconnected from the world. But that's a safety net. I mean, what it really is a safety net. I mean, you know, I'm the expert. I actually think some academics are thrilled to learn that only 3 to 8 people read their articles. And I know that sounds crazy, but I do. I think it's like a relief to some people. Like they got the credit for doing it, but they didn't really have to expose themselves. And there's no safety net in art.
I was actually going to say that. I do wonder if some people like the fact that it's a very small, very select audience, and there's no vulnerability there, is there?
Yeah, not at all. And I get that. And look, people should not expose themselves in ways they don't want to. And I'm certainly not a believer that everyone has to create art and that all academics have to create art. And there are other ways to be creative without putting your art out in the world. But the critique against it, that's where I draw the line. Like, you don't have to do arts-based research. I don't have to do quantitative research, but I don't have to spend my life critiquing it either. Because I actually do think it's a valid way of knowing. And I think it helps us ask certain kinds of questions and get certain kinds of information. And it doesn't help with other things, and that's okay. So the visceral response that some academics have to the idea of arts-based research is, to me, it's very, very fear-based. And that somehow it's going to delegitimize what they do, make what they do less valuable, make them less able to stay disconnected in these ways. And so that's where my sort of issue is. But yeah, look, there's great safety in, like, you know, writing something that nobody's going to read. You know, there is. And I'm not saying that's what you should strive for, but like, I understand it.
Yes. And it also ties into that impression of academics as essentially not really human beings, just producers, godlike producers of stuff. I think one of the wonderful things about your novel Spark is it's actually a portrait of diverse academics with all their vulnerabilities and foibles and personal characteristics. Well, I'll ask you a little bit about that in a while, but I just want briefly to touch on the idea of ethics, which was kind of running through what you were saying previously, and I know you've talked elsewhere about there being an ethical imperative for making scholarship as publicly accessible as possible, and also about the way your own sociological research on women's lives has been, you've been able to make it more powerfully impactful, which in a way has an ethical imperative by using creative practice. So could you just say something a bit more about that ethical argument for arts-based research?
Yeah, absolutely. And in a lot of ways, it's recap of what we've been talking about, but traditional research practices result in findings that are completely inaccessible to the public, to the very stakeholders that might benefit the most from research. And I believe firmly that research should be available to the many, not the few. And look, I'm somebody, I have a PhD, but my mother came to the United States as an immigrant, as a refugee, actually. English is her second language, and she only has a high school education. And I don't feel like I'm any more entitled to information or knowledge than she is. And that's a problem with the way that the research system is set up, that it privileges people like me and people like you to have access to information that people like my mother don't have. And to me, that's just plain morally wrong. And what's the point of doing research? I mean, there's that famous saying, you know, the candle is not there to illuminate itself. So there needs to be some ethical mandate beyond a line on our CV for why we are doing this work and why we are putting it out in the world. And as we already talked about, you know, people just don't have access to traditional academic reporting. And in my own work, so turning to fiction as a research practice completely transformed my work on women's lives, making it accessible inside and outside of the academy, and arguably much more engaging and impactful. And that's another thing. It's, you know, so I mean, I've literally been going through airports throughout the world where I've seen people reading my novels. I've had people send me pictures that they're on a beach and they see someone reading one of my novels. I've zoomed into book clubs that are non-academic. They're just regular folks who chose to read one of my novels very kindly in their book club. And at the same time, my novels have been widely used in the academy. They've been used in undergraduate and graduate courses. They're regularly course adopted and actually include further engagement in the back of most of them so that professors can easily incorporate them into classes. So I can say, as someone who's done both nonfiction and fiction, that it is my fiction that has actually gotten audiences both inside and outside of the academy. And I can tell you from the comments that readers make, the emails I get, the things students have said to me over the years, there's just no question that the fiction has made an impact on them in a way that nonfiction never could. I could spend hour upon hour upon hour giving lectures about the things I've learned studying women's lives all these years, and it will likely be forgotten as I'm saying it. But if somebody reads a novel and they happen to connect with it, they happen to connect with a character, that the impressions from that can last a lifetime. And I can tell you that, you know, my debut novel, Low Fat Love, came out 10 years ago. I still get emails about it. I still get messages. I have some people tell me that they reread it once a year. It's like a ritual they go through because it was meaningful in their lives. And it's by no means a great novel. It's mediocre at best. And so I don't think it's because it's brilliant per se. I think it's because it resonated with people in a way that a journal article, a conference presentation, or a lecture just simply never would.
I'll ask you more about your novel writing now, because we're on the topic of it. Spark, which I read recently, is sort of wonderfully entertaining and also very, very accessible. I can absolutely see why you would get that engagement from wholly non-academic audiences, from book clubs and so on. But it's lots of different things. In a way, it's kind of a slightly mischievous ethnography of academics, and very, very funny in lots of places. But as you say, it does also have sort of further reading at the end. And when you read it and look back on it, you think, absolutely, this is an entertaining, highly engaging novel, but also would sit very comfortably as an undergraduate text, prompting students to engage with things that they need for moving forward in academia with research and ways to think critically and so on. I wonder how you came to that balance of having almost a pedagogical underpinning and purpose, that this could be a textbook as well, but also being kind of hyper accessible. How did you land on that kind of mode of writing for your novels rather than as somebody coming from an academic background ending up in a slightly sort of highfalutin critical creative box that would actually end up being hardly read by any more people than the journal articles?
Well, you are extremely kind. So thank you for reading it, for your very generous comments. So I have to tell you the story of how I came to write it, which will answer your question. And often I get asked, like, how do you come up with the ideas for your different novels and that sort of thing? And I'll just say it happens differently each time, which is why I'm completely in love with writing still. So it just never happens the same way twice. Sometimes it'll be a very specific experience. Sometimes I'll just hear a song. Sometimes an idea will seemingly come to me out of nowhere, although I believe it comes from somewhere that, you know, maybe is sort of the metaphysical realm, so we can't understand it. You know, sometimes there's a theme I want to explore, and so I find a way to write fiction to explore it. It just never happens the same way twice. So, okay, I had an idea many, many years ago, actually before I even started writing fiction, that it would be really cool to write a novel about the research process, critical thinking, problem solving, all that kind of stuff. And I never wrote it. I just had the idea. And then when I started writing fiction, I did return to that idea and I thought, gee, I wonder if there's a way to do it, because the two things I love the most are the research process and sort of critical thinking, thinking about ideas, and writing fiction, and using literary arts in order to learn about things and express those things. So these are the two things I love the most. And I was like, okay, I really want to combine these ideas. I'm going to find a way to write a novel about the research process, critical thinking. And I thought and I thought and I thought about it. And I thought, you know what? Not possible. Like, who would want to read that novel? It doesn't even sound good to me. It just sounds horrible. So I scrapped the idea. And then as luck or fate would have it, a few years later, I received the invitation of a lifetime. It was absolutely the coolest invitation I ever got. In fact, my assistant forwarded the email to me, and in their email said, "This is either spam or the coolest invitation you have ever received." And it was not spam. It was an invitation to participate in the Salzburg Global Seminar, which is a very famous seminar in Austria that takes place in a castle, which is actually the Real Sound of Music house where they shot all the exteriors for that film. And this Salzburg Global Institute owns this castle in real life. And they began in 1947. And since 1947, they've been curating groups of scholars, artists, thinkers, lay citizens, people from around the world to come for these different week or so long events. And I was invited. I was one of 50 people invited to the Salzburg Global Seminar session on neuroscience and art. What are the sources of creativity? That was the topic. And so, of course, I went. It was literally the coolest invitation I ever received. It was like getting like the golden ticket or whatever in like Willy Wonka. And all expenses paid. I'm very lavish, just an incredible thing. And I'd say when I was there that about half the participants were neuroscientists, and they were famous. I mean, they were like the people in neuroscience from around the world. And probably the other half were artists. Artists in all different media, some of whom were quite famous and would be people that you know of. So Ben Folds, the musician, for example, was a participant. It was just amazing. I sort of considered myself one of the like regular people there. You know, I'm an arts-based researcher. I'm a novelist. I was an outlier in some ways, but the organizers apparently were familiar with my work. So they invited me. And we spent this week, we were divided into groups, and we spent time in our small groups as well as in the larger group as a whole. And it was very different from Spark in some ways, where for people who haven't read Spark, this academic Peyton gets invited to a special seminar in Iceland, where she's going to be surrounded by some of the greatest thinkers in the world. She's put into a group with seven people, and they have to answer one really ambiguous and sort of dumbfounding question. And they have the week to do it. And without giving anything away, the last page of the book, I give you the answer to the question. But really, it's a journey about coming together across differences, different ways of looking at the world, different disciplines, critical thinking, what all of that looks like and feels like. So anyway, when I was in Salzburg, we were given very specific questions. So it was quite different than the fictional experience that Peyton had. But I was in a group with a couple of neuroscientists and artists who became a very good friend of mine. And we are still very good friends to this day. And it was a very diverse group. And I can tell you that when we were in that smaller group, we fought like cats and dogs. I mean, it was like, we just fought like cats and dogs. But then we would have these incredible lavish meals together, drink bottles of wine together. The musicians would entertain us at night. We would go down to this pub in the cellar of the mansion. And we would stay there playing pool, talking, dancing, you know, until the wee hours, and then we would start again the next day. And while there were some people who I really didn't get along with during the lived experience, and I'm sure would say the same about me, we absolutely love and adore each other now. We are all still, years later, this was about 5 years ago, I suppose, we're all still on a listserv together. There was actually just a virtual reunion the other day, which unfortunately I had to miss because I had a medical appointment I couldn't get out of, but we're all still close. Many of us have collaborated. A couple of the people from that seminar contributed chapters to the Handbook of Arts-Based Research. So anyway, while I'm there in this castle with these brilliant thinkers and we are fighting like cats and dogs and then partying every night like dear old friends, I had the idea for this novel spark. It just suddenly came to me. I was like, oh my God. This is how you do it. This is how you write a novel about the research process, critical thinking, a collaboration across differences. And as soon as I left Salzburg, my husband and I went to Vienna for a few days just for a vacation. And when we got to our hotel, my husband was in the shower. And in the 15 minutes or so that he was showering, I wrote the entire outline to Spark, including every character's name and the last line of the book. And I actually put it aside after that because I was working on other projects. But whatever it was, a year or so later, a year and a half maybe, I picked up that outline and I wrote that novel. So thank you again for your kind words. But that's how it came to be. It actually came from this experience of cross-pollination and transdisciplinarity, which was really incredible.
We're almost out of time. We could go on and on. And I'd very happily let this run for another hour. There's much more that we could talk about, but we are pretty much out of time. But that means I have to put our final standard closing question to you. If you had a magic wand, and remember, it's a magic wand, so you can do anything you want with it. It can be as wild as you can think of. What one thing would you use that magic wand for to change that would help foster creativity as widely as possible in higher education?
I would make arts integration a priority across the disciplines. So while, of course, I think that art education is itself important, so that would be teaching the arts for their own sake, arts integration uses the arts to teach other subject matter. And it's a vital component of creativity. It breeds cross-pollination, transdisciplinarity, lots of the things that we're talking about. And all of the research on arts integration in education shows that no student is disadvantaged by it. So a student who would learn a subject well without the arts integration will still learn it well. But there's a whole host of students that will learn it better because of the arts integration. And I do believe that if we were teaching this way, and we were especially teaching young kids this way, elementary schools and in high schools, that ultimately we would need to have this conversation about creativity in the academy, creativity in research practice, because we would be already trained to do that.
Patricia Levy, thanks so much for joining us. There is so much rich detail and ideas and hopefully inspiration in that conversation. And I very much hope that some of our readers might take this inspiration to step out of that space of the 3 to 8 readers and maybe see what will happen if they let things flow in free writing or any other kind of arts practice. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.